Now, this is one of those sections. A lot of these sections that we're looking at in this section of Acts, like there's a lot of stuff happening. So we're going to read through this. I just want us to try and take in what's happening. I'll pause along the way and make a few pointless comments probably. But we're going to start reading from Acts 22, verse 22. Now, I will just say before I start on that, the first thing we're going to read is saying, oh, as soon as Paul said this, then this happened. So it's useful for us to be reminded of what it is that's just happened. So we've got Paul here, who's somebody who, when we first encounter him, is setting out to persecute Christians. And as early churches are popping up, he's actually going out to try and shut them down, to arrest people or worse. And he encounters Jesus on the way. And he goes from being the sort of biggest persecutor of Christians to the biggest sort of church planter we know about in the early days of the church. And he's going everywhere now, not persecuting people who follow Jesus, but persuading and preaching about Jesus. And that becomes a bit controversial because he starts preaching that to Gentiles. Gentiles are people who aren't Jews. And he's been doing a load of different stuff, but this is, he's back in Jerusalem. And it's all kicked off because people who were already a bit suspicious of him are accusing him of taking a Gentile into the temple. And it sort of becomes like violent. And then there's Roman soldiers there that sort of pull Paul out of this because they can see it's a violent situation. This guy could get sort of torn to pieces. And then Paul says to the commander, like, can I speak to the crowd? There's a bit of a confusion. He thinks, oh, he's somebody else. No, but then he agrees to speak, let him speak to the crowd. And he starts speaking to the crowd and telling them his story, which is similar to what I've just told you there. Look, I was a very sort of serious Jew. I took it really seriously, followed all the laws. I went out to persecute churches, but Jesus appeared to me, and then I've been following Jesus. And the last thing that he said in the speech, which is verse 21 of Acts chapter 22, is, then the Lord said to me, go, I will send you far away to the Gentiles. And so then we'll pick it up in verse 22. The crowd listened to Paul until he said this, that thing about the Gentiles. Then they raised their voices and shouted, rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live. As they were shouting and throwing off their cloaks and flinging dust into the air, the commander ordered that Paul be taken into the barracks. He directed that he be flogged and interrogated in order to find out why the people were shouting at him like this. As they stretched out to flog him, Paul said to the centurion standing there, is it legal for you to flog a Roman citizen who hasn't even been found guilty? When the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and reported it. What are you going to do? He asked. This man is a Roman citizen. The commander went to Paul and asked, tell me, are you a Roman citizen? Yes, I am, he answered. Then the commander said, I had to pay a lot of money for my citizenship, but I was born a citizen, Paul replied. Those who were about to interrogate him withdrew immediately. The commander himself was alarmed when he realized that he had put Paul, a Roman citizen, in chains. The commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews. So the next day he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the members of the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and set him before them. Now, Sanhedrin was sort of like the Jewish court, had all the sort of Jewish leaders, the important people in there. And so it's really still this Roman commander trying to find out what's going on why there's all this commotion. Every time he's been sort of letting Paul interact with them, it's all kicking off. So he now brings them all together and like, let's sit down, let's have a, like, work out what's actually the issue. So chapter 23, Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, my brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all good conscience to this day. At this, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck. Those who were standing near Paul said, how dare you insult God's high priest? Paul replied, brothers, I did not realize that he was the high priest, for it is written, do not speak evil about the ruler of your people. Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees, and the others Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, "My brothers, I am a Pharisee, descended from Pharisees. I stand on trial because of the hope of the resurrection of the dead." When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees believe all these things. There was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously. "We find nothing wrong with this man," they said. "What if a spirit or angel has spoken to him?" The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." So like the Roman commanders brought all, like, let's get all the like leaders in the room. Let's get Paul in the room, work out what's happening. And it's all kicked off again. It says it becomes so violent that the Roman commanders had to pull Paul out again for his own safety. Pick it up in verse 12. The next morning, some Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We've taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we've killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petition the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. We are ready to kill him before he gets there." But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." So he took him to the commander. The centurion said, "Paul, the prisoner has sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you." The commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside and said, "What is it that you want to tell me?" He said, "Some Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them because more than 40 of them are waiting in an ambush for him. They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they've killed him. They're ready now, waiting for your consent to their request." The commander dismissed the young man with this warning, "Don't tell anyone that you've reported this to me." Then he called two of the centurions and ordered them, "Get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Provide horses for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix." He wrote a letter as follows, "Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency Governor Felix. Greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and they were about to kill him, but I came with my troops and rescued him, for I had learned that he is a Roman citizen. I had wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. I found that the accusation had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him." So the soldiers carrying out their orders, excuse me, just grab a drink while I'm reading it. So the soldiers carrying out their orders took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. The next day they let the cavalry go on with him while they returned to the barracks. When the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor and handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Sicilia, he said, "I will hear your case when your accusers get here." Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. Right, so well done for sticking with it there. It's an action-packed sort of story. There's loads of stuff happening. Paul's life is under threat. Every time he speaks, there's people kicking off. It's getting violent. Like, they're having to pull him out for his own safety. The Roman commander just seems, bemused. Why does it keep on kicking off? I can't understand what's going on. Like, he's done nothing deserving of this. And all this sort of stuff happens to Paul. I'm going to just mention really three things that have stood out to me as I've been thinking about this over the last few weeks. We'll start off by thinking about the sort of two things that cause people to kick off here. Like, what is so controversial? And the first one is that bit that was just before we started reading, because it says, when they heard him say this, they started kicking off. That's my translation. What was it that he said? It was the fact that he was saying that God had told him to go to the Gentiles. They are absolutely fuming about it. Like, the language they use is like intense. Rid the earth of him. He's not fit to live. It's not just like, oh, we have a little disagreement. They want him dead. They say he's not fit to live. They're throwing off their cloaks. They're picking up dust and flinging it, which I think is a great image. I don't know why. But they're just absolutely furious. Now, why are they so mad? Well, if you're familiar at all with the Bible, you know that this conflict between Jews and Gentiles, or this animosity between them. One person who's sort of studied the time said this: the Jew had an immense contempt for the Gentile. The Jews said that the Gentiles were created by God to be fuel for the fires of hell. It was not considered lawful to render help to a Gentile woman who was giving birth, because that would be helping to bring another Gentile into the world. The Gentiles were an object of utter contempt to the Jews. The barrier between them was absolute. If a Jewish boy married a Gentile girl, or vice versa, the funeral of that Jewish boy or girl would be carried out. They weren't dead, but the family's carrying out a funeral. They're saying that you're dead to us. Such contact with a Gentile was the equivalent of death. That was the sort of mindset that was common at the time. And so Paul's saying, oh, God's sending me to the Gentiles. They might be, oh yeah, right, great. The only reason God would send somebody there is to like wipe them out or declare judgment on them, not to go and declare God's good news to them. Is that controversial today, that God's good news is available for everyone? It's probably not as controversial as it was then. But the only reason why it's not controversial to us in the way it was to them is because we have this basic idea that everybody's equal. That if there is a God, he'll treat everyone the same. But we only have that idea because of the influence of Christianity, because of what Paul was doing here. Most cultures throughout history, including at the time that Paul was speaking here, wouldn't have believed that everybody was born equal, or that God should or would treat everyone the same. The only reason why we believe that is because our culture has been so influenced by this teaching. Whether we acknowledge the source of it or not, that's just a fact. One writer who's written a lot on this idea is Glenn Scrivener. He's wrote a brilliant book called The Air We Breathe, just talking about how just the assumptions that we have in our sort of Western culture about how the world works are really all from Christianity, whether we recognize it or not. And on this idea of equality, he points out this story that came up during the sort of pandemic lockdowns. And Lord Sumption, who was a former UK Supreme Court Justice, was on an interview talking about the value of lockdowns and stuff like that. And he said this statement: I don't accept that all lives are of equal value. Now, what he was arguing about lockdowns and stuff like that is a different debate. That's not really what I'm talking about here. But that statement caused an absolute uproar. And he was later involved in an interview with a woman who was vulnerable. I think she was somebody who was having to do the full shielding. And her challenge to him was, look, I'm one of these people. Are you saying that my life has no value? And he interrupted her and he was like, no, I didn't say no value. I just said less valuable. That didn't make it any better. Like, if he was trying to explain himself, that didn't help. Like, and he came under like loads and loads of criticism for those comments. Why are we all so outraged at that statement? Because we have this fundamental belief in equality. But that's because we've been influenced by what Paul is saying here. Our culture has been totally shaped by this. We're not outraged like the Jews are when Paul said, I'm going to the Gentiles. If anything, we're outraged at their response. But that's because we're all on Paul's side. Whether you like Paul or not, whether you've heard of Paul or not, we're just all on his side because this argument has shaped the culture that we live in. We don't even notice it. So I think that's why it doesn't seem controversial to us, and why it seems a bit strange that they would all kick off so much about it. But I think on a personal level, it is still a bit controversial. It's possible for anyone, absolutely anyone, to repent and receive the forgiveness and acceptance that's offered through Jesus' life and death and resurrection. Absolutely anybody. It's possible for absolutely anybody to access that. Absolutely anyone, including people you don't like, including people you don't think it should be available for, including people you think have crossed the line, have gone way over the line. The good news of the gospel is available for absolutely anyone. That's good news. It's really good news because, firstly, we are all Gentile. I mean, I don't know everybody in here. Maybe there's somebody who's got a Jewish sort of lineage, but for the most of us, we're all Gentiles. And we've had our lives, I've had my life transformed by Jesus because of what Paul was doing here, which is saying, right, I'm going to the Gentiles with this message. And it's good news because, as I've just said, it's available to everyone. There's a sort of author and speaker called Ray Ortland, an American guy who planted a church where every week at the start he would say what he called the Emmanuel Mantra. Emmanuel was the name of the church. And he said, like, the mantra of our church has three things in it. Firstly, I'm a complete idiot. Secondly, my future is incredibly bright. Thirdly, anyone can get in on this. Like, whoever you are, I don't know everybody in here. Whatever your situation is this, I'll say this confidently, this good news is for you. This is available for you. That's what was getting Paul in so much trouble back then. It's still true today. The good news is for you. The second thing that caused everybody to kick off is a bit different. So this is when he's gone at the Sanhedrin, this sort of Jewish sort of court type thing. And there's a great uproar. Again, it says it becomes violent. I can sort of imagine like a big crowd sort of becoming violent and aggressive. But this is like a sort of courtroom of religious leaders. And this becomes so violent that the Roman commander has to pull Paul out of it. And it's all because Paul like throws this grenade into the middle of the room of like, oh, this is because I believe in the resurrection. And that causes everybody to kick off. Why was that controversial? Well, it explains it in the passage. It's because within this council, you've got two sort of different groups, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Both sort of different like factions or groups within Judaism at the time that Jesus was around and after, which is what we're reading about here. Now, there was a lot of similarities to them. They were both very serious about God's law. They both had some sort of level of power within the sort of Jewish system. The Sanhedrin, which is what we're reading about here, the sort of Jewish court, had people that were Sadducees, had people that were Pharisees. The differences between them, there's the obvious one that is mentioned here that causes such an issue, and it's mentioned elsewhere, it's mentioned in the books of Matthew and Mark, that the Sadducees did not believe in such a thing as the resurrection of the dead. Now, we're not talking about the resurrection of Jesus here. I'll come on to that in a second. But they didn't believe that there was going to be a future resurrection when you died. The Pharisees did believe in a future resurrection. So the Sadducees sort of denied that idea of life after death, whereas the Pharisees did believe that after you died, there was a future. And, you know, some people are going to be rewarded, some people are going to be punished. But that was a significant difference between them. The Sadducees tended to be wealthier and they tended to be in more powerful positions. The chief priests, high priests were usually Sadducees. The Pharisees were more representative of the common sort of working people and they tended to be more respected by the average Jew on the street. And so Paul, it says, he sees that, oh, we've got Sadducees and Pharisees here. And he says, my brothers, I'm a Pharisee. I'm descended from Pharisees. I stand on trial because of the hope of the resurrection of the dead. And that causes the dispute to kick off. It goes violent, as I said. It gets a bit ridiculous, I think, this, because the Pharisees are then saying, like, look at verse 9. Some of the teachers of the law who were Pharisees stood up and argued vigorously, we find nothing wrong with this man. They say, oh, there's not, we've got no problem with him. Now, that is just absolutely not true. They do have a problem with Paul. The Pharisees hated Jesus. They don't want Paul spreading the message of Jesus. Definitely they don't want it spread to the Gentiles. So they were probably among the people who were flinging the dust in the previous thing. Now, I say, oh, we've got no problem with him. We've got no problem with him. It just shows that this like religious argument that they've got with the Sadducees is so like all-consuming to them that they're willing to say, oh, look, there's nothing wrong with him. Anyway, it's the resurrection that causes the issue. Is this controversial to us today? Possibly not. But that's because many or most people, including many Christians, are like the Sadducees. Maybe very spiritual, maybe very serious about God, but with a focus on this life, that everything's about this life. And the resurrection of the dead is just a fanciful idea. Or maybe it is like, maybe you're more like one of the Pharisees, that you do believe in a resurrection in the future. There's a basic good hope for things, like good things after death. But that's not the resurrection proclaimed by Paul or by Grace Church. What we are proclaiming and what Paul was proclaiming is Jesus' resurrection from the dead. We believe that Jesus was physically raised from the dead, that he died, he was actually dead, and then he came back to life. It's not just an inspirational story. It's not just a metaphor or in like an illustration to help us learn something. I actually believe that that happened. And if you're thinking, well, that sort of thing doesn't happen, that's the point. That's why it's such a big deal. If it did happen all the time, then it wouldn't be so much of a big deal. But we believe in the resurrection that Paul was proclaiming, which was Jesus' resurrection. Now, Jesus' resurrection is described as the first fruits of what will happen to us. And so when we look into the future and when we talk about having what our hope is for eternity, it's not disembodied or floaty or vague. It's physical, it's solid. It's a hope that we will be physically present in a new creation, living lives in a perfect world forever. It's good news. It's really good news. And so the two things that cause great controversy here, and nearly had Paul getting beaten up by a mob, are things that are good news to us. That God's love and acceptance and forgiveness through Jesus is available to anyone, absolutely anyone. And that Jesus died, but then rose from the dead. And that gives us hope for the future. That's the good news that Paul is getting, like he's willing to risk his life for. And that's the good news that has transformed so many of our lives in here. And the final thing I wanted to mention is just the idea that we see through this section, but through all of this, this entire book, really, of God's unstoppable plan. Paul's life is in danger multiple times here, but every time, you know, something happens and he's rescued. Firstly, it's like Roman citizenship. So this is the second time in the book where Paul has used his Roman citizenship to either highlight or prevent mistreatment and injustice against him. So like they've pulled him out the crowd, the Romans, they say, oh, like they're being nice, but they intend to like flog him first and ask questions later. But then he says, no, like, is it lawful for you to do that to a Roman citizen? And they back way off. Paul says he was born a citizen. And it's not immediately clear when I've read through the commentaries, like people have different ideas about how that's been the case, that he was born a citizen. But I just think it's fascinating that it says he was born a citizen. Paul was rescued by some circumstances of his birth. Like God was arranging things here before Paul was born so that in this situation he could say, oh, is it lawful for you to flog a Roman citizen, and that he would be rescued. God can have things in place for your benefit before you know that there's even a problem. And the second thing is just like the system of Roman justice. So there's this secret plot to sort of like, we're going to not going to eat until we've murdered Paul by these 40 people. Well, it's a secret plot, but nothing's secret from God. So this plot isn't going to stop God's plan. And Paul's nephew just happens to overhear about this plot and passes it on to the Roman guards. And then they sort of take him to the local governor under like a heavily fortified armed escort. God used the Roman sort of justice system and the Roman machine to keep Paul safe. He used other people. Paul's nephew, who I said just happened to be in the right place at the right time. There's plenty wrong with the Roman Empire, but God uses their system of justice here to save Paul's life, just like he uses their roads to spread the good news of the gospel. No matter what's going on, God's plans are unstoppable. And sometimes it's seemingly miraculous to us. You know, there's times where Paul and others are rescued in ways that just seem like a crazy miracle. And then other times it's just through circumstances and through other people. It's still God working. Now, yesterday I was at the funeral of my granny. She was 94 years old. It was a happy occasion. And she was born in 1930, so with a funeral like that, you're hearing loads of stories of loads of things that have happened and that she did during her life. One of the things that stood out to me was just the circumstances around her sort of marriage. So she was called Daryl. She studied for did a music degree at Cardiff University, then wanted to be a music teacher. And she couldn't get a job in that area for whatever reason. And so moved quite a long way to a town called Wigton, which is sort of near Carlisle, which she lived for the rest of her life, really. There she met a young married couple with a young son who'd also moved, don't know why, but moved from Great Ayrton over to Wigton. That was William and Joan. William was also a teacher. He worked with Daryl. They got to know each other that way. She also became friends with Joan because they sang in a choir. A couple of years later, Joan died. And then a couple of years after that, leaving William with this three-year-old boy. A couple of years after that, Daryl married William and became the mum of this little boy, it was called Alan. That's my dad. It's a happy story, this. I don't know really why I'm finding it difficult to tell. I was thinking about that in relation to this, just because it's an unexceptional story, but it's just God's great kindness to me, Dad, to be arranging things before there was even a problem. You know, these people moved to this obscure town, really miles away from where they lived. There wasn't even a problem, but God was working things. And then when there was a problem, he moved this young woman with compassion to become part of that family. And my dad had the blessing of that then for the rest of her life. It's not dramatic, it's not spectacular, but it is God's loving, generous provision through circumstances and through other people, which is how he works throughout history. Now, it's not really the same thing as what happened with Paul. I just want to tell that story, really, to honour me, Granny, and because it was that idea of things were going on before there was a problem and God using other people and God working in unspectacular ways. It was really God's unstoppable blessing rather than what we're seeing here in Acts, which is God's unstoppable plan. Often he's using normal means, circumstances, other people, Roman justice. Whether he does it like that or does it by a miracle, his plan is just totally unstoppable. Don't know if you noticed verse 11 in the middle of this, and we'll just finish with this. Verse 11 of chapter 23, this when Paul was sort of being brought into the barracks for his own protection, it said, "The following night the Lord stood near Paul and said, 'Take courage. As you've testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome.'" Jesus has told Paul, "You're going to testify in Rome." So Paul knows that's going to happen. Now, there's all sorts of weird twists and turns along the way, but Jesus has said it, so it's going to happen because his plan is unstoppable. I think this is really comforting on a personal level. You can sleep tonight. His plan is unstoppable. Now, that doesn't mean difficult things aren't going to happen. Obviously, Paul would have preferred if God's plan didn't involve him getting flogged or all these things, or plot to kill him or whatever. But his ultimate plan is unstoppable. And his plan is to transform you into his own likeness. His plan is to give you hope and a future. And that is absolutely unstoppable. No matter what comes against it, it can't be thwarted. But what we're seeing here as well in the book of Acts is not just a personal encouragement. It's about the early church. these Jewish leaders are trying to cut off the early church in its infancy. And it didn't work because God's plan was for the church to go to the Gentiles. God's plan was for the church to reach this country. God's plan was for us to become part of the church, to hear that good news, have our lives transformed and become part of his people. No matter what plans come against or what plots, secret plots, violence, theological debates, whatever it might be that comes against God's church, it didn't work then, it won't work today. God's building his church and that's an unstoppable plan. When we read these stories about Paul, today we're reminded so much of Jesus, who was also rejected by his own people, who was also unjustly arrested, who was also falsely accused. He was the victim of secret Jewish plots. He was slapped in the face in a Jewish court. Now, these particular threats against Paul didn't actually come to anything, but the threats against Jesus weren't empty. Like, they worked. Jesus was killed. And God's plan was abruptly thwarted. Except it wasn't, because 3 days later he rose from the dead and walked out of the tomb. Let's finish with these words from earlier in the book in Acts chapter 2 when Peter, who was one of Jesus' disciples, stands up and says to the crowd this: "Fellow Israelites, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders and signs, which God did among you through him, as you yourself know. This man was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. But God raised him from the dead, freeing him from the agony of death, because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him." God's plans are absolutely unstoppable. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the good news which Paul devoted his life to sharing, and that he devoted his life to sharing with everyone, including Gentiles. And we're so grateful for that, Lord, that your plans are available for us, no matter who we are and what we've done, that we can come before you on our knees and have our sins forgiven. That there's nothing in this room too great to be forgiven by your grace. That there's no one in this room too far gone to be welcomed in to your family, to receive your love and acceptance and affection. We thank you for that good news of the resurrection that Paul preached. That we're not just looking back on a historical teacher that we try to emulate, but we are living alongside a God who's alive and active in our lives, a God who's conquered death, a God who's shown us what our future holds, a resurrected life in a physical creation for eternity. And we thank you that your plan for this message to transform lives across the world is unstoppable. No matter what comes against us personally, no matter what comes against us as a church around the world, nothing can stop this good news. We read that nothing could stop it then, and we're confident that nothing can stop it now. And so I pray that would give us great freedom and comfort as we rejoice in that good news for ourselves and share it with other people. Amen.